This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
Hello. This is me, Gary Clanton, and this would be episode 109 of Night Transmissions. You know, I don't really have much in the way of hard and fast rules, and those few that I have, I break all the time. But one set of guidelines is that the first half hour, I try to bring you a mystery, a crime story, a trial, you know, something like that. Which brings me to Crime Classic. This is one of my favorite. It has a nice, light touch to it. It's sometimes called a docudrama. I do that myself sometimes. But, you know, maybe that's a bit too much. The stories are often considerably fictionalized. That said, though, as near as I can tell, the 27 or so minutes presented here of the checkered life and sudden death of Colonel James Frisk seems to be pretty accurate. James Frisk was a real person and quite a prominent figure in New York of the 1860s and 70s, well, the early 70s. He gets bumped off as the story opens on January 6th of 1872, at the age of 37. If I have any bone to pick with the story tonight, and it's a very frail bone indeed, is that in listening to the story, you get the impression that Frisk was much older than that. During that time, those brief 37 years, he ran away from school in 1850 and joined the circus. No, seriously, he joined the circus. It was called Van Amburg's Mammoth Circus and Menagerie. Then he would become a waiter, and then, following in his father's footsteps, he became a peddler. Now, he learned a lot about show business in the circus, so he goes out and he applies what he learned in the circus to his father's business. Gangbusters. He made a fortune for his father. Leaving his father, he became a salesman for a dry goods firm. But he really wasn't that good a salesman. But he was an excellent profiteer. There were many profiteers during the Civil War. Also, apparently, he tried his hand at cotton smuggling across enemy lines. However he did it, he did soon accumulate considerable wealth, which he lost in speculation. In 1864, he became a stockbroker, and this worked pretty well for him, too. To summarize it all, he was an interesting character. His life was the basis of a movie, a highly fictionalized movie from 1937 called The Toast of New York. And on a more serious note, there have been a couple of biographies written on him, including one from 1872 that's in the public domain. I linked to that at the website. If you want to know a little bit more about all of this, you can go to the website, nighttransmissions.com, and follow the link to download the e-text. A little bit of a teaser, I suppose, is the blurb from the book. The Life and Times of Colonel James Frisk, Jr., being a full and impartial account of the remarkable career of a most remarkable man, together with sketches of the all-important personages with whom he was thrown into contact, and a financial history of the country for the last 3 years, embracing also the lives of Helen Josephine Mansfield and Edward S. Strokes. Mansfield and Strokes, as you listen to this, you understand they were his undoing.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland. I'm going to tell you another true crime story. Listen. The man who just fell down the stairs is Colonel James Fisk, Jr. Although the Colonel is a man given to the consumption of dozens of Blue Point oysters and bottles of heady wine at a sitting, his friends were given to pointing him out as a man inordinately steady on his feet. So why did he tumble down the stairs? And in New York's Grand Central Hotel, no less, where stair tumbling was frowned upon, the Colonel didn't slip. He wasn't pushed. He was shot. The sudden presence of two bullets in him had upset his equilibrium. The man who's running away is the man who just shot the Colonel. His name, Edward S. Stokes. Until recently, the Colonel's very dear friend. There he goes. And tonight, my report to you on the checkered life and sudden death of Colonel James Fisk, Jr.
Crime Classics. A series of true crime stories taken from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. And now once again, Thomas Highland.
Colonel Fisk lay at the bottom of the stairs a few minutes before 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, January the 6th, 1872. He was dying. His life was coming to an end. And he would be sorely missed by his family, Mrs. Fisk and the children, and by his intimates, among whom were Jay Gould, Boss Tweed, and the heavier stockholders of the day. A man dying, and I know the precise instant when his dying began. It started some months ago in a rather ornate house in Washington Square. Two women were talking, and the younger one said,
"Annie, how can I meet Colonel Fisk?"
That was the instant. And the older one said,
"Oh, dearie, dearie, dearie."
But the younger one was not young enough to take dearie for an answer.
"I mean it, Annie. I want to meet him.
He's so wealthy, isn't he?
And all I have is a black and white silk dress and an empty purse. So very empty, dear Annie."
"Oh, often's in the rain, and empty purses sadden me so, dear Josie."
"And I've heard he's coming here tonight to visit with you."
"The dear Colonel says I set such a good table." Dear Josie.
"Yes?"
"Walk over there to that cabinet, dear Josie. In the very bottom drawer, you will find two candlesticks given to me by the minister from Egypt. Get them." "Yes. They are heavy, aren't they? Now put them on the table. Mm-hmm. And light them. Good. Now blow them out, gently.
Well, Annie?"
"Dear Josie, will you join the dear Colonel and me for dinner tonight?"
"So nice of you to ask. I'd be delighted, dear Annie."
And so it was that Colonel Fisk and Josie Mansfield met. It was a highly successful meeting.
"I kiss your hand, Josie."
"You're a very sweet man."
"Isn't she a dear?"
"So lovely."
"And so poor."
"So sad."
The Colonel was a man easily touched. And this was the era for young widows, beautiful and penniless. It was the era for weeping at the mere thought of such a situation. It was a decade of compassion and champagne. And this night, the meeting night, was one of the most poignant of the decade.
"Tomorrow, Josie, a jewel to lie against the throat."
"Oh, Colonel."
"My carriage will call for you at noon and bring you to me."
"And where will you be?"
At Tiffany's.
The necklace counter?
Of course, my dear. More wine? Diamonds become you.
Oh, Colonel. Oh, Colonel.
Look at it, dear. Do you like it?
It's very nice.
And it's all yours.
Oh, thank you. I've always wanted a home of my own. And servants of my own?
Six.
Kiss me, Colonel.
Good evening, Colonel.
Evening, Quimby. This is Mr. Stokes.
May I take your cane, sir?
Thank you, Quimby.
The
mistress is in the drawing room. She's waiting for you.
This way, Stokes.
Hello, Colonel. And you must be the Colonel's best friend, Mr. Stokes.
I hope this is no imposition, ma'am.
Preparing dinner? Certainly not. I just sat here all day, listening to the new present the Colonel sent me, while the servants made ready.
Do you like the new music box, my dear?
It reminds me of you when you're away from me.
Such a pretty speech. How fortunate you are, Colonel.
Oh, wait till you taste her pheasant a la Esther.
I can hardly wait.
Will you two excuse me for a moment?
Where are you going, Colonel?
I left a small package for you out in the carriage, my dear.
Oh, of course. We'll excuse you. So, you're Mr. Stokes.
So you're Josie.
I must say he was right. You are elegant.
He was right. You are very lovely.
You're younger than he told me.
And you're...
What?
You are.
Will you help me light the candles?
Josie.
Will you help me with the fireplace?
Josie.
The music box is run down. Will you...
Josie.
You won't help me with anything. You're wicked.
Yes, I am.
You're very wicked.
At the time Josie whispered this tender criticism, Mr. Edward Stokes was 5 feet 9 inches high. His head was covered with glossy curls, his complexion clear, his features regular, and his eyes dark blue. He was dressed in the height of fashion, and his diamond studs gleamed brilliantly. And after the Colonel returned with a forgotten package...
Oh, a ruby pendant. Thank you, Colonel.
You're very welcome.
And after the wine was drunk and venison devoured, and the fingers dipped in the lemon water, after that evening of old friends anew, after that, there was a new day. And there was this.
Good morning, Mr. Stokes.
Good morning, Quimby.
The mistress is in the sitting room. She's waiting for you.
Thank you, my man. Josie.
Edward. Oh, wait, Edward. I was out this morning early shopping. Here, I bought something for you. Open it.
Josie, a pearl stick pin. There was no need for you to...
Oh, yes, there was. Now be quiet.
Several other scenes between these wild, storm-tossed lovers you might care to eavesdrop upon, since they'll give you a better understanding of the currents sweeping these two upon violent shores, like this one.
The best champagne in New York. Now take off your little shoe. Here, use my mallet, dear. This croquet has brought the pink to your cheeks. Make your shot.
is always the case in skullduggery of this sort, there is an in the meanwhile. So, in the meanwhile, in the Park Avenue home of Colonel James Fisk, Jr., the colonel and his lady, the children have been tucked away for the night, the servants snug in their quarters, as were the animals. A quiet hour. An hour for a man and his wife. And for family discussion.
You fool! You cheat! Blackguard!
Dear, the children, you'll awaken them.
A woman like that.
Have you no compassion in your heart? She's a widow.
Ha, ha.
Alone in the world. I am but her advisor.
Ha, ha. Now that's all you are.
What are you talking about?
What all of New York is saying.
And that is?
Ha, ha.
And that is?
The most concerned is the last to know.
Know what?
Your precious widow and Edward Stokes.
What?
Ha, ha, Colonel. Now you know what I've been through. The aggravation, the shame, the heartache, the sorrow, the unrequited love.
I'm sorry, Colonel. It's so late at
Quimby.
Night.
Where is...
The mistress is in her boudoir.
Go awaken
her.
Who
is it, Quimby?
It's not Mr. Stokes, ma'am.
Why, good evening, Colonel.
What's this I hear about you and that scamp, Edward Stokes?
Why, what have you heard?
That you and he...
Who told you that?
My wife.
You'd better go back to her, Colonel.
Then it's true.
I love him very much.
Josie.
Go back to your wife.
I warn you.
You warn me? You, Colonel?
Listen to me. I'll ruin you.
Please. Go home.
You and Edward Stokes. Mark my word. I'll ruin the both of you. My promise to you, if it takes the rest of my life.
The colonel left. The colonel was driven to his club, where the colonel spent the night. And the next morning, early, the colonel began the final week of his life.
Your Honor, I want to swear out a warrant for the arrest of Edward S. Stokes for embezzlement.
Why, certainly, Colonel. We'll have the culprit in jail in no time at all.
Inside with you, Mr. Stokes.
Jailer.
Yes, sir, Mr. Stokes.
Do you have the list?
Yes, sir. Your living room furniture, the portraits, and the bed. I'll have them here in no time at all.
Edward Stokes was a model prisoner for 2 days. He was then released when the charge against him was dropped. Not to be outdone, he went into action in a manner which gained the plaudits of his cronies.
Your Honor, I want to swear out a warrant for the arrest of Colonel James Fisk, Jr. for false imprisonment.
Why, certainly, Mr. Stokes. We'll have the culprit in jail in no time at all.
Jailer?
Yes, sir, Colonel. The living room furniture, your easy chair in the library, and the bed. I'll have them here in no time at all.
War of nerves, tactics, and strategies, and reprisals. And the real victors, the gatherers of the loot, the lawyers. So the Colonel and Mr. Stokes called a truce, waved white napkins at each other across a gleaming table at Delmonico's.
Stokes, I think we've both acted like children.
I agree with you, Colonel.
Let me fill your glass. Yeah. A toast. To a friendship.
Our friendship, Colonel.
Enough of jails and lawyers and arguments. Life is too short.
I'll drink to that, too. Colonel?
And we can settle our affairs like men.
I'll drink to that, too.
No, wait. Let's settle our affairs first.
Delighted.
There is only one thing which stands in our way.
Obviously.
Josie Mansfield.
You're right.
Stokes, you're not ever to see her again.
Colonel?
You agree?
Colonel, you're a fat, stupid fool.
I accept that. But you're never to see Josie Mansfield again.
Josie told me that if I saw you, I was to tell you are a fat, stupid fool.
And you are. I warned you once, Stokes. I'm not going to warn you again.
Then I'll warn you. If you make any trouble, Colonel, you won't live to enjoy it. My promise to you.
Good evening, Mr. Stokes. The mistress is in the parlor.
Josie. Josie. Josie, wake up.
Oh, Edward. How nice, Edward.
Dearest, listen. It's important. Are you awake?
Well, of course, I just drowsed off. I was reading, waiting for you, and now you're here.
Josie, listen. It's about Colonel Fisk.
Oh, please don't talk about him. Not now.
He's ruined me.
What are you talking about?
I am a pauper.
You? Well, you're one of the wealthiest young men.
No, not now. I don't have a penny.
What happened?
The stocks I had, all my assets.
Well?
The colonel forced down the value of the Erie Railroad stocks, wiped me out.
Oh, Edward, I'm so sorry.
Josie.
Yes?
I'm poor now. Do you want me to leave? Never come back?
Darling Edward. Darling, dearest Edward.
Josie.
We'll beat him. We'll destroy the colonel, you and I together.
That's impossible. He's too powerful.
He's a weakling.
What?
I can prove he's a weakling. He writes letters.
Letters?
I saved them. And that's not all.
What do you mean?
Dealings he's had. Dishonest business dealings. Would you like to look at them?
Dearest Josie, I love you so much. So that's why I thought it more discreet to hire a cab, Colonel. Surely you understand.
I must tell you, Stokes, when I agreed to meet you, to ride with you in a hired hack at night...
I explained the necessity of secrecy, Colonel.
As indeed you did not. You merely said secrecy. That is why I must tell you I am confused. Have you made another decision about Josie?
A tentative decision, Colonel.
Tentative?
Yes, it depends on you.
Oh?
I need money.
I know.
Badly.
I know.
Colonel...
Yes?
You love Josie very much, don't you?
I understand you now, Stokes.
I thought you would.
You want me to reimburse you for the money you've lost?
$250,000.
I know. In return for which, you'll give up Josie.
That's right.
I'm sure there must be a name for you, Mr. Stokes.
I'm sure of it.
I had an experience last night. I had dinner at home with my wife. The children were with us. After dinner, I played on the floor with my children. I heard them laugh. I heard my wife laugh, too. And I laughed, too. And there was no other meaning behind my laughter except enjoyment of my family.
Very touching.
And rewarding.
Then you're not interested in my proposal.
I'll get off at the next corner, Mr. Stokes. Tell the driver.
Of course. Next corner, cabbie.
Well, Mr. Stokes, give my regards to Josie. Tell her I'm truly sorry for what's going to become of her. Goodbye, Mr. Stokes.
Colonel, wait.
I'm sorry, we have nothing else to talk about.
Except the letters.
What letters?
You have a rich way with words, Colonel. I congratulate you.
I don't understand.
Oh, of course you do. The letters you wrote to Josie.
I see.
All of them.
I see.
They could ruin you.
Perhaps.
I remember one of the letters opened with, "Dearest Josie, my poor little widow, your sad tears still on my shoulders."
$10,000.
And another... "Dear Josie, this morning I was at Tammany Hall, and with Boss Tweed, arrangements were made to relieve the city..."
$10,000.
$250,000 for the letters, Colonel.
$10,000, or you may publish them or do what you want with them.
Surely you're not serious.
Good night, Mr. Stokes.
$10,000.
Bring your letters to me tomorrow, and you shall get your money. Good night.
Almanac I have occasion to call on now and then, says that Saturday, the 6th of January, in the year 1872, is the 66th anniversary of the Volunteer Fire Department of Roanoke, Virginia. Also, it predicts the day will be cold and clear with high westerly winds. So, we'll make an assumption. On a cold, clear Saturday morning, buffeted by the high westerly winds, Mr. Edward Stokes made his way to the Wall Street office of Colonel Fisk. Here he received more coldness and $10,000. Here he deposited with the colonel a stack of letters, wrapped in blue ribbon and sachet. Then Edward Stokes called on Josie Mansfield. He told her of the transaction. We must imagine that Josie's reaction went something like this.
You idiot! You bumbling, spineless idiot!
But Josie...
I should have known better than to trust you with those letters.
But $10,000 is better than nothing.
If you'd had the courage...
He told me $10,000 or nothing.
If you'd had the courage, he would have given you everything he owned. Why, the mere possession of the letter dated June 16th, 1871, would have been a fortune 10 times the amount you got.
But...
But what?
You have your jewels, this house. Surely you must be worth nearly $1 million yourself.
I love you, dear Edward, but that's my money. You'll just have... What is it, Quimby?
Miss Annie Wood wishes to speak with you.
Tell her I'm busy.
She said it's extremely urgent.
Extremely urgent.
Hello, Annie.
Josie, dear Josie, and dear Mr. Stokes.
Hello.
The judge came to see me for lunch a little while ago.
Judge? What are you talking about?
Judge Tripler.
Well, I don't see.
He just come from court. He just signed a warrant.
Yes?
For the arrest of dear Mr. Stokes on the charge of blackmail.
Colonel Fisk?
Yes. The dear judge told me that the colonel asked him to sign such a warrant. Josie?
Yes?
We'll be seeing each other more often, won't we, dear Josie?
Publication of the time. I quote, "The next that was seen of Edward Stokes, as far as is known, was at a few minutes before 4 o'clock, when he was walking carelessly up and down the main corridor of the Grand Central Hotel on the parlor floor. This corridor is one story above the street, is parallel with Broadway, and at its northern end is reached by a staircase from the street. Passing and repassing the head of the staircase, Stokes glanced furtively down the stairs. It was nearly 4 o'clock when Colonel James Fisk, Jr. drove up in a carriage to the door. Stepping out of his carriage and walking briskly across the pavement, he passed through the outer door of the hotel. When he had done so, he was heard to inquire for a certain Annette Latour. He was told she was in and started up the stairs.
Good afternoon, Colonel.
Stokes, don't!
You'll ruin me.
For the love of heaven, someone help me!
Edward Stokes was restrained a block away. The colonel didn't die immediately. He was lifted by 3 bellhops and taken to chambers supplied by the management. Doctors were called, and the colonel joked with them, as he joked with his many friends who came to visit him. He joked with everybody. Next day, in the middle of a joke, he died. Thomas Stokes pleaded self-defense. He was convicted of manslaughter in the 3rd degree. Josie Mansfield spent her remaining days with her aunt, Miss Annie Wood. James Fisk, Jr., tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. James Fisk, Jr. was played by William Johnstone. Featured in the cast were Mary Jane Croft, Martha Wentworth, Steve Roberts, Harry Bartell, Paula Winslow, and Charles Calvert. Bob Lamond speaking.
Has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back. One of the talents that I have always most admired from old-time radio is Arch Obler, whose facility with dialogue and characterization as represented in these old shows, I don't think has ever been exceeded. His work on Lights Out is some of the best radio drama ever done, before or since. Lights Out was created by another major talent of the time, Wallace Cooper, in 1934. Arch Obler took over in 1936, and the show would last until 1947. Tonight's episode is a very interesting play, as a woman reminisces a future life in bits, in pieces, in fragments. And unlike so many Lights Out stories, it has a happy ending. That's what it's called, Happy Ending. And it's on June the 23rd of 1937.
Lights out, everybody.
Arch Obler bringing you another in our series of Stories of the Unusual. Our scene, a doctor's office. The doctor, a genial middle-aged man, is smiling across his desk at young Mrs. Peggy Conlon. And he's saying,
"Well, Mrs. Conlon, I don't think there is much more I can say other than this. Don't be too afraid. This sort of thing has been going on since the beginning of time. Millions of women. So don't be frightened. Go home. Tell your husband. Be happy."
"Thank you, Doctor. Goodbye."
"Goodbye."
"Thank you. I'll walk."
"Okay, miss."
"Walk. Yes, I'll walk. Takes longer when you walk. No longer to get home."
"Baby, baby, 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 baby."
"Home. What will he say? What will he say?"
"Baby, baby, baby, baby."
"What will Bill say? What? What?"
"Oh, it's out of the question, Peg. Out of the question on the money I make. Now, look, this isn't confetti. It's bills for groceries, bills for laundry, bills for gas. I tell you, Peg, it's out of the question.
Out of the question, out of the question. He'll say out of the question.
Baby, baby."
"What will he say? Oh, Bill, what will you say?"
"Hey, hey, watch the light, lady."
"Oh."
"There, watch where you're going, little lady. Them lights are for you as well as for the car."
What will Bill say?
"What? What did you say? Say you don't feel well or something. Your face, I mean."
"Oh, I'm all right, officer."
"Sure you don't want a cab?"
"No, I'm walking home."
"Okay. But watch the traffic at the crossing."
"If I take shorter steps, it'll take longer. Yes, shorter steps."
"Do you realize it'll set us back for the next 5 years?"
We won't be living. We'll always be paying bills for doctors, for hospitals, for nurses, for this and for that.
Paying.
Will he say that?
Well, it's been going on since the beginning of time. Millions of women. So don't be afraid. Go home. Tell your husband. Be happy. Be happy. Happy.
Happy. Doctor said that, didn't he? Happy. Bill, we have been happy.
Rowing. I don't think I'm going to row anymore. Too hot. Just drift. Now, what was I talking about?
Happiness.
Oh, yeah, happiness. Now, you know, I think that the most important thing in life is to be happy. Don't you?
Oh, yes, Bill.
Now, you take ordinary people. On a day like this, what are they doing? Working in factories, working in offices, working. Isn't that right?
Yes.
But the park is here, the lagoon is here, the boats are here. Man, if they just had a little common sense, they'd say, the devil will work, we're going to be happy. And they'd come out here and they'd go boat riding.
4 million people. The lagoon would be awfully crowded, wouldn't it, Bill?
No, I'm serious. All right, so I'm not working today, so I'll have $5 less. But I'm doing what I want, and I'm happy.
I'm happy too, Bill.
Are you? Honest, Pete?
Uh-huh.
Oh, gee. When I think that only 2 days...
And I wasn't even going to the dance.
I took one look at it.
Oh, but that's a song, Bill.
Oh, it's the truth. Oh, gosh, I'm happy about you, Pig. I'm happier than I've ever been in my whole life.
Happy. We have been happy.
Let's try that kiss again.
We're not.
Oh, Bill. We're good.
You mean we're loud? Loud.
Don't drive so fast.
Oh, I'm in a hurry.
Why, Mr. Bones?
I'm on my way to get married. I'm on my way to get married.
Oh, Bill, they'll think you've been drinking.
I have. 4 Cokes, a double malted, 2 kisses, and a marriage license. Yee-hee!
Bill, behave yourself.
Oh, no. The bride and the bridegroom's been a heavy night in jail. Hey.
Huh?
Starting to rain. Shall I put the top up?
Oh, no, please.
Huh?
Want the rain in my face. Oh, it's wonderful, Bill. The wind and the rain. I feel as if I were flying.
Oh, Mrs. Angel.
You know, all my life I thought that if I ran away to get married, I'd be so frightened. But I'm not afraid the least little bit. I love you, Bill. And everything's wonderful, and I'm so happy. So happy. We've been so happy.
Should I?
Well, I don't know, Bill.
Well, speak up, Mrs. Connor, or forever have to hold your peace.
That's 30 cents already.
Oh, I was only warming up. One more time and I know I can hit it.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, mister, I'll try her again.
That's the here, son. One for a dime. Knock down the top bottle and win the little lady at Brett's big, beautiful doll.
Okay, Pete.
Here I go.
Oh,
you hit it, Bill!
I told you I would. Okay, mister, pay off.
Well, it be, little lady, a Q-P or a Popeye?
Popeye.
Oh. Here you are.
Thank you.
You can do the same, ladies and gentlemen, with a text.
Oh, Bill, isn't it cute?
Yeah. Hey, let's sit down over here.
All right.
Oh.
Darling, you're wonderful.
Wonderful? And hungry.
Oh, Bill, after 4 hot dogs, 3 sodas, and all those peanuts, you ought to be sick.
I am, but I'm hungry.
Bill.
Find this Bill from the Ozarks, get me?
Bill, you're so crazy, and I love you so much.
You talk like that, and I'll kiss you right in the middle of the midway.
Double dare you.
Hey, maybe there's a law against kissing your own bride.
Maybe there's a law against being so happy.
You got the prettiest little funny face.
You know, I used to think that when I got married, I'd be going to the French Riviera, Honolulu, and, you know, places like that, and here I am, Luna Park.
Oh, Peg.
No, darling, you don't understand. I like it. I'm happy about it. Why, I'll bet there are thousands of women who've been to all those famous places who'd give every minute of it to be in my place with someone she loves and who loves her. Women are really awfully simple people, darling. They want love. And I have you, and I'm happy. Terribly happy.
Go home. Tell your husband, be happy. Be happy. Be happy.
I could be happy. Mother. Peggy Conlon.
Mother.
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 My mother. mother.
You mark my words, he'll never make a good living for you, never. No drive, no ambition, a worthless young man. Never make a good living for you, Peggy. You'll never have anything. You mark my words. Just mark my words. For the last time, listen to me, daughter. Now, if you marry that boy, you'll cry a great deal more, believe me. Oh, stop crying, Peggy, and listen to me. Someday you'll be a mother, and you'll understand that I'm telling you these things for your own sake. When you have children of your own, you'll understand.
Understand what, Mother? Understand what? Should I understand now? If you were alive, could you make me understand now?
Well, Bill's all right. He's all right, I tell you. It's just that he used to laugh. He laughed all the time.
But how can he laugh now?
Brent.
Gas, Dennis. Mike, Carter.
Brent.
Gas,
Dennis.
Mike, Carter.
Bill.
That's what I don't understand, Mother. Doesn't the world want people like Bill who can laugh? Must everyone be wonderful at making money? Isn't there a place for people like Bill who don't want a great deal? Can't things be so that they can make the little they need without growing so old and tired they forget what it is to laugh? And be happy at just being alive?
Fine mess. We're in a fine mess. Where will we get the money? Where will we get the money, Peggy? Where will we get the money?
No! Thinking things like that. Got to. Think about him.
Shine? Shine, lady? Shine? Shine, mister? Shine? Shine?
What will he be?
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Drift in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have like a fool's away to dusty death. Our brief candle life but a walking shadow. A poor...
Oh, death. No! No.
And so, my fellow citizens, standing here in profound humility, where so many of our truly great have stood, all there is left to say is this. In accepting this high office and in assuming the leadership of our great nation in these troubled times, I pledge myself...
No.
In that moment, he realized he no longer loved Semicolon. In that moment, the past with her, comma, last year, hyphen, drenched moment, comma...
Maybe...
So it is with a great deal of pride that this network brings to you the premier radio performance of the world's premier violinist.
David
Conant.
Maybe.
And my diagnosis of the patient only confirms my profound belief that such diseases can be cured.
Maybe.
So, an investment of these issues, with my concern, will net you profit of not less than the sum of twice your investment.
Oh, no. Oh,
silly Peggy.
You used to say that, didn't you, Mother? Silly Peggy. Because I laughed at the wrong time. Maybe I laughed then. Maybe I'm laughing now because I'm afraid.
It's happened to women for millions of years.
No, not that. Pain goes quickly, I know it, but... Bill. What'll Bill say? No, stop thinking. Stop thinking. Slowly. Very slowly. What was I thinking? Oh, yes, my boy. I'll be so much wiser by the time he grows up. Give him advice.
Yes, Mother. Of course, Mother. Yes, I'm listening. You're wonderful, Mother. Oh, you're right, Mother. Just as you say, Mother.
No, not like that.
You're wrong, Mother. I it, Mother. No, Mother.
No, not that way.
Why, Mother? Explain, Mother. Tell me if you know, Mother. Why is it like that, Mother?
Yes. Look like. What will he look like?
Lovely child.
May I hold him? Looks like you.
His father's hair.
Beautiful child.
Beautiful child.
Beautiful child. Yes, why not? Why not? David Conan. Beautiful child.
Baseball, read all about it. World crisis, world crisis, war in Europe. Read all about it. War.
War.
Baby.
Bill, what if he says it?
Read the newspapers, I tell you. Read the newspapers. There's your answer. Raise them up so they can blow him up. The answer's in your newspapers, I tell you, Peg. Raise them up to blow
him
up.
What can I answer him? I'm not good at answers. If Bill says that, what'll I say?
So I said to him, I said, Joe, I will not go for a run. And he said, why not? And I said, why should I? And he said, well, you, if you don't, when will you? So I give him a smile, you know. And he said, you look here, Helen, if you
see that. Girl. Maybe it'll be a girl. Yes, why not? Girl. Mother. A lovely girl.
Mother, you think my dress hangs right. Isn't it too long? Or is it too short? Don't you think I would have it made a little frill here?
No wars. Killing, dying, just...
Mother, you think I ought to go out with him after what he said to me?
Mother, I don't think that's a good school, really, I don't.
Cannon fodder, bomb fodder. Raise him strong and blow him up. What's the good of it, Peg? What's the good of it?
No, can't be like that. Not with a girl. Ruth. No.
Anna.
No. Nina. No.
Elizabeth.
No.
Carol.
Yes. Carol Conan.
Carol Conan, the season's
Carol
prettiest
Conan.
Figure, John.
Brilliant
Carol
young...
Conan, beautiful young.
Carol Conan is nationally known.
What could she be?
Mother, do you know all about babies? Do you know? After all, look at me. Well, I was wondering about Junior. He won't eat his cereal. He won't touch his bottle. I don't know what to do. I simply don't know what to do.
Maybe.
Carol Conan, opera, tonight. Curtain, 8:30.
Yes.
My daughter.
Oh, you'd be so proud of her, Bill. You would. Almost there. Walk slower. Oh, Bill, don't get angry when I tell you. God, don't let him be angry. I couldn't stand it if he yelled at me. I couldn't. I'm afraid. Bill, if you knew I was afraid, you'd help me, wouldn't you? Afraid of you. That's not right, is it? Walk slower. Walk slower. If, when I get there, Bill, and you look at me, if then, for the first time in my life, I can say everything I've been thinking before you have a chance to say anything, then you'll understand how I feel, and because you love me, you won't say anything that'll hurt me, and you'll take me in your arms. Oh, Bill, but I can only think things. I can never say them clearly when they should be said. Maybe everybody's like I am. Talk when it's too late. But this time I've got to talk now, right away. The minute I get in the house, because if you talk first and say things that hurt me, you and I will never... Oh, Bill, all I want is to be happy, just a little. Everything's so mixed up all over the world that... Bill, all I know, all I want is...
You say something, Mrs. Conan?
Oh, Mr. Tomasi.
What's the matter? You walk right up past the house, huh? Yeah, maybe you're thinking you don't live here no more, huh?
I was so preoccupied, I didn't notice.
Sure was a hot day, huh, Mrs. Conan?
Yes, it was. I don't like to go in.
Oh, but your husband, he's home, huh?
Home?
Sure, he come about it 10 minutes ago. I'm going to see him go upstairs.
It is late, isn't it?
Sure. You put it in the girl, but when a husband to come home from work and a wife and not home, sometimes you get a plenty mad, huh? I bet you're scared, huh?
I better go up.
Hey, I'm going to come up and put you soon and fix that water faucet.
All right. Good evening, Mr. Gold. You're playing very well tonight.
Yeah, yeah. In 60 years, even a fool learns to do something.
Oh. The baby all right?
Oh, yeah, lots better. Let's see.
He's so tiny, isn't he?
You like the baby, Miss Conlon?
Well,
I know. They look like lots of trouble, but you bet you for people what got little babies, the whole world.
Yes.
Believe me, baby's good. Good night.
Good night, Mrs. Maslow.
Peggy, is that... Peg?
Bill!
Gosh, Peg, where you been? I've been worried stiff.
Was it just walking?
I got home. There was nobody here. I was ready to do a calling all car, so help me. What, are you going to stand here by the door all night? What's the matter, Peg? Oh, honest, I don't care if there isn't any dinner. Yeah, I'm so full of love for you tonight, one potato in me, and I'd pop like a kid's balloon.
Bill, I want to tell you...
No, wait, I'm going to tell you.
Me?
Yeah, come on over by the window. Phew, it's hot. That's better. Nice breeze to keep you cool while I burn you up with the news right off the press.
News? Bill, I...
Flash! Ambition comes to Billy Connor.
Bill, if you'd let me tell you...
No, how can you tell me when I'm trying to tell you? Now listen, sweet funny face. Today, the great lords of industry unlocked the octopus long enough to hand Billy Connor... Now, hold your breath. $5 more a week.
Bill, I've got...
Yes, oh, help me. $5. Oh, is that terrific, Peg? We move right into the upper bracket. Got everything we want.
Bill, please listen to me. I've got
to... Sure, as soon as I finish my say... Now, I got to say it, Peg, because I've been kind of getting obscene to say it all the way home from the office. Now, all this may sound a little screwy to you, but here goes.
Bill, I want to tell you today...
Oh, please, funny face, don't interrupt to tell me about the bargain you saw today, because, well, if I stop talking, I'll lose my nerve, and then maybe I won't ever say it again. Peg, this $5 a week, now that's over $250 a year, and I began thinking right away how we could spend it.
Spend?
Yeah, you know me. So, I got thinking about maybe we'd get another car. But the old jalopy's pretty good yet, and then I thought maybe we could take a cottage someplace. But then I don't get a vacation until next year. So, then I got thinking... Why, heck, what's the matter with me? Why should I be afraid to talk to you?
There's no reason to be afraid. Is there, Bill?
Oh, of course not. See, what I'm trying to say is that... Well, look at the newspaper headline.
The war, yes, I thought...
The world going to smash, maybe. So I got thinking, the heck with it. There isn't time enough to go anywhere or plan anything, and who wants money anyway? So, how can we spend it to make both of us really happy? You know, to make our lives... if one of us should die before the other, make our lives means something.
Means something.
Oh, Peg, I got to say it faster. I won't be able to say it at all. Peg, let's spend the money for a kid. Well, Peg, what do you look at me like that for? Oh, I know we never talked about it, but... Well, I was kind of scared of the idea, and I didn't know if you'd want one. Well, Peg, for Pete's sake, say something. Looking at me... Well, what did you want to tell me before? Say that at least.
Oh, Bill. Bill. Wait till you hear.
Smoke hung in heavy clouds, and the one ashtray was full to overflowing. It was almost dawn, and the gamblers were tired. Three of them were not only tired, but disgusted as well, because sitting in neat piles before mild little Mr. Smith, the Dude Easterner, were almost all of the chips on the table. One of the players spoke.
Smith, you've got luck like I've never seen before.
Smith's weak eyes blinked behind their heavy glasses, and his smile was timid.
You sure are right, Mr. Bender. I've never been so lucky before.
After Smith had cashed his chips and gone, the three men that had been in the game counted their losses. They amounted to over $800. One of the men, Bill Sutton, was even more unhappy than the others.
How does he do it? By all the rules of poker, the three of us playing together as partners should have cleaned him. Instead, he walks off with all the money. If it was anybody else but that little guy, I'd say he was stacking the cards.
The man on his right, Jim Bender, spoke.
Me too. But I've watched every move that he's made, and I haven't seen him do a crooked thing. He's just lucky, that's all. Too doggone lucky. And I'll be glad to see him leave town. Say, I've got an idea. Why don't we help him make up his mind to leave, huh? That was a good idea, isn't it?
The other two men shot puzzled glances at their partner.
This little guy is the luckiest one we've seen, are you right?
The other men nodded.
And this is Nevada, and there's no way we can keep him out of an open game, as long as he wants to play. Now, if his luck holds like it has for the last two nights, we'll soon be broke, you right?
Again, the men nodded.
Well, I've got a plan to get rid of him. Now, my brother's in town, and they're getting rid of him.
The others came close around him, and their low voices could be heard until gray light began to fill the morning sky. That night, little Mr. Smith left his hotel and started toward the poker game. As he passed a dark slot between two buildings, a large hand reached out and dragged him into the narrow space.
Your name, Smith?
Why, yes, Samuel Smith.
My name's Haggerty, and we Haggerty's got a feud with the Smiths. We done killed off all the Smiths in this section until you come along, and now it looks like we got to kill another one.
You mean me?
Your name's Smith, ain't it?
Yes.
Well, then I've got to kill you. But I never killed a man without giving him a chance. I'm going to count 10 and then start shooting.
Smith felt the hand on his collar let go, and he darted back onto the sidewalk and up the street. As he safely rounded the corner, two shots flamed in the darkness. Less than an hour later, the four gamblers roared with laughter. Safely aboard the bus, Sam Smith was also laughing. Last night after the game, when he had sneaked around to find out if they were onto his tricks, he had been worried about getting out of town with their money, but they themselves had provided the excuse. He settled back with a sigh of satisfaction. Sam Smith, the slickest card shark ever to be kicked off the Atlantic Run, was going to enjoy the Wild and Woolly West. This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
Men, Frank Crummett is here with me to say a word about Roy Tan Cigars. Frank Crummett.
I'm really a fan for Roy Tan, and the reason is Roy Tan has more long filler Havana tobacco, and yet it's a 5-cent cigar. Man to man, smoke Roy Tan.
Now we come to Mind Webs, The Life of Other Days. From June the 3rd of 1979, Mind Webs ran on WHA radio from Madison, Wisconsin, from 1976 to 1984. And they were actually a bit more like audiobooks than audio drama. Maybe someplace in between. These folks took some of the best science fiction short stories around and gave them a dramatic reading, usually with multiple performers taking on the parts of various characters. Although occasionally, like the show we have here, it's just one person reading the story. And in my humble opinion, this is about as good as it gets. I don't know a lot about Bob Shaw, really. I haven't read much of his stuff. And like so many people whose work appears on this show, he's dead. He's been dead since 1996. Sit back and listen to this melancholy story of Slow Glass.
Welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen with a Mind Web story, and this time that originally appeared in Analog, 1966. It's reprinted from World's Best Science Fiction of 1967. It's Bob Shaw's Light of Other Days. Leaving the village behind, we followed the heady sweeps of the road up into a land of slow glass. I had never seen one of the farms before, and at first found them slightly eerie, an effect heightened by imagination and circumstance. The car's turbine was pulling smoothly and quietly in the damp air, so that we seemed to be carried over the convolutions of the road in a kind of supernatural silence. On our right, the mountains sifted down into an incredibly perfect valley of timeless pine, and everywhere stood the great frames of slow glass, drinking light. An occasional flash of afternoon sunlight on their wind bracing created an illusion of movement, but in fact, the frames were deserted. The rows of windows had been standing on the hillside for years, staring into the valley. And men only cleaned them in the middle of the night when their human presence would not matter to the thirsty glass. They were fascinating. But Selena and I didn't mention the windows. I think we hated each other so much, we both were reluctant to sully anything new by drawing it into the nexus of our emotions. The holiday, I had begun to realize, was a stupid idea in the first place. I thought it would cure everything, but of course it didn't stop Selena being pregnant. And worse still, it didn't stop her being angry about being pregnant. Rationalizing our dismay over her condition, we had circulated the usual statements to the effect that we would have liked having children, but later on at the proper time. Selena's pregnancy had cost us her well-paid job, and with it the new house we had been negotiating, which was far beyond the reach of my income from poetry. But the real source of our annoyance was that we were face to face with the realization that people who say they want children later always mean they want children never. Our nerves were thrumming with the knowledge that we, who had thought ourselves so unique, had fallen into the same biological trap as every mindless rutting creature which ever existed. The road took us along the southern slopes of Ben Cruachan until we began to catch glimpses of the gray Atlantic far ahead. I had just cut our speed to absorb the view better when I noticed the sign spiked to a gatepost that said, Slow Glass, quality high, prices low, J.R. Hagen. On an impulse, I stopped the car on the verge, wincing slightly as tough grasses whipped noisily at the bodywork. Why have we stopped? Selena's neat smoke silver head turned in surprise. Look at the sign. Let's go up and see what's there. The stuff might be reasonably priced out here. Selena's voice was pitched high with scorn as she refused, but I was too taken with my idea to listen. I had an illogical conviction that doing something extravagant and crazy would set us right again. So I said, come on. The exercise might do us some good. We've been driving too long anyway. She shrugged in a way that hurt me and got out of the car. We walked up the path of irregular packed clay steps, nosed with short lengths of sapling. The path curved through trees which clothed the edge of the hill. And at its end, we found a low farmhouse. Beyond the little stone building, tall frames of slow glass gazed out towards the voice-stilling side of Cruachan's ponderous descent towards the waters of Loch Linney. Most of the panes were perfectly transparent, but a few were dark, like panels of polished ebony. As we approached the house through a neat cobbled yard, a tall, middle-aged man in ash-colored tweeds arose and waved to us. He had been sitting on the low rubble wall that bounded the yard, smoking a pipe and staring towards the house. At the front window of the cottage, a young woman in a tangerine dress stood with a small boy in her arms, but she turned uninterestedly and moved out of sight as we drew near. Mr. Hagen, I guessed.
Correct. Come to see some glass, have you? Well, you've come to the right place.
Hagen spoke crisply with traces of the pure Highland accent that sounds so much like Irish to the unaccustomed ear. He had one of those calmly dismayed faces that one finds on elderly road menders and philosophers. I told him, yes, we're on holiday and we saw your sign. Selena, who usually has a natural fluency with strangers, said nothing. She was looking towards the now empty window with what I thought was a slightly puzzled expression.
Up from London, are you? Well, as I said, you've come to the right place and at the right time, too. My wife and I don't see many people this early in the season.
I laughed.
Well, does that mean we might be able to buy a little glass without mortgaging our home? Look at that now, Hagen said, smiling hopelessly. I've thrown away any advantage I might have in the transaction. Rose, that's my wife, says I never learn. Yeah, still, let's sit down and talk it over.
He pointed at the rubble wall, then glanced doubtfully at Selena's immaculate blue skirt.
Wait till I fetch a rug from the house.
Hagen limped quickly into the cottage, closing the door behind him. Perhaps it wasn't such a marvelous idea to come up here, I said to Selena. But you might at least be pleasant to the man. I think I can smell a bargain. Some hope, she said, with deliberate coarseness. Surely even you must have noticed that ancient dress his wife was wearing. He won't give much away to strangers. Was that his wife?
Of course that was his wife.
Very well. Anyway, Selena, try to be civil with him. I don't want to be embarrassed. Selena snorted, but she smiled whitely when Hagen reappeared, and I relaxed a little. Strange how a man can love a woman and yet at the same time pray for her to fall under a train. Hagen spread a tartan blanket on the wall, and we sat down, feeling slightly self-conscious at having been translated from our city-oriented lives into a rural tableau. On the distant slate of the loch, beyond the watchful frames of slow glass, a slow-moving steamer drew a white line towards the south. The boisterous mountain air seemed almost to invade our lungs, giving us more oxygen than we required. Hagen said,
Some of the glass farmers around here, they give strangers such as yourselves a sales talk about how beautiful the autumn is in this part of Argyll.
Or it might be the spring or the winter. I don't do that. Any fool knows that a place which doesn't look right in summer never looks right. Now, what do you say? I nodded compliantly. I want you to take a good look out towards Mall, Mr. Garland. Hey, Mr. Garland, that's what you're buying if you buy my glass, and it never looks better than it does at this minute. The glass is in perfect phase. None of it is less than 10 years thick. And a 4-foot window will cost you £200. 200? Selina was shocked. 200, that's as much as they charge at the Sindo shop in Bond Street. Hagen smiled patiently and then looked closely at me to see if I knew enough about slow glass to appreciate what he had been saying. His price had been much higher than I had hoped, but 10 years thick. The cheap glass one found in places like the Vistaplex and Panorama stores usually consisted of a quarter of an inch of ordinary glass faced with a veneer of slow glass. It was perhaps only 10 or 12 months thick. You don't understand, darling, I said, already determined to buy it. This glass will last 10 years, and it's in phase. Doesn't that only mean it keeps time? Hagen smiled at her again, realizing he had no further necessity to bother with me. Only, you say. Pardon me, Mrs. Garland, but you don't seem to appreciate the miracle, the genuine, honest-to-goodness miracle of engineering precision needed to produce a piece of glass in phase. When I say the glass is 10 years thick, it means it takes light 10 years to pass through it. In effect, each one of those panes is 10 light years thick, more than twice the distance to the nearest star. So, a variation in actual thickness of only a millionth of an inch would... He stopped talking for a moment and sat quietly looking towards the house. I turned my head from the view of the lock and saw the young woman standing at the window again. Hagen's eyes were filled with a kind of greedy reverence, which made me feel uncomfortable and at the same time convinced me Selina had been wrong. In my experience, husbands never looked at wives that way. At least, not their own. The girl remained in view for a few seconds, dress glowing warmly, and then moved back into the room. Suddenly, I received a distinct, though inexplicable, impression she was blind. My feeling was that Selina and I were perhaps blundering through an emotional interplay as violent as our own. I'm sorry, continued Hagen. I thought Rose was going to call me for something. Now, where was I, Mrs. Garland? 10 light years compressed into a quarter of an inch means... I ceased to listen, partly because I was already sold, partly because I had heard the story of slow glass many times before and had never yet understood the principles involved. An acquaintance with scientific training had once tried to be helpful by telling me to visualize a pane of slow glass as a hologram which did not need a coherent light from a laser for the reconstitution of its visual information, and in which every photon of ordinary light passed through a spiral tunnel coiled outside the radius of capture of each atom in the glass. This gem of, to me, incomprehensibility not only told me nothing, it convinced me once again that a mind as non-technical as mine should concern itself less with causes than effects. The most important effect in the eyes of the average individual was that light took a long time to pass through a sheet of slow glass. A new piece was always jet black because, well, nothing had yet come through. But one could stand the glass beside, say, a woodland lake until the scene emerged, maybe a year later. If the glass was then removed and installed in a dismal city flat, the flat would, for that year, appear to overlook the woodland lake. During the year, it wouldn't be merely a very realistic but still picture. The water would ripple in sunlight. Silent animals would come to drink. Birds would cross the sky. Night would follow day. Season would follow season. Until, one day, a year later, the beauty held in the subatomic pipelines would be exhausted and the familiar gray cityscape would reappear. Apart from its stupendous novelty value, the commercial success of Slow Glass was founded on the fact that having a Sindo was the exact emotional equivalent of owning land. The meanest cave dweller could look out on misty parks, and who was to say they weren't his? A man who really owns tailored gardens and estates doesn't spend his time proving his ownership by crawling on his ground, feeling, smelling, tasting it. All he receives from the land are light patterns, and with Sindos, those patterns could be taken into coal mines, submarines, prison cells. On several occasions, I've tried to write short pieces about the enchanted crystal, but to me, the theme is so ineffably poetic as to be paradoxically beyond the reach of poetry, mine at any rate. Besides, the best songs and verse had already been written, and with prescient inspiration, by men who had died long before Slow Glass was discovered. I had no hope of equaling, for example, Moore with his "Oft in the stilly night ere slumber's chain has bound me, fond memory brings the light of other days around me." It took only a few years for Slow Glass to develop from a scientific curiosity to a sizable industry. And much to the astonishment of we poets, those of us who remain convinced that beauty lives though lilies die, the trappings of that industry were no different from those of any other. There were good Sindos that cost a lot of money, and there were inferior Sindos which cost rather less. The thickness measured in years was an important factor in the cost, but there was also the question of actual thickness or phase. Even with the most sophisticated engineering techniques available, thickness control was something of a hit-and-miss affair. A coarse discrepancy could mean that a pane intended to be 5 years thick might be 5.5, so that light which entered in summer emerged in winter. A fine discrepancy could mean that noon sunshine emerged at midnight. These incompatibilities had their peculiar charm. Many night workers, for example, liked having their own private time zones. But in general, it cost more to buy Sindos which kept closely in step with real time. Selena still looked unconvinced when Hagen had finished speaking. She shook her head almost imperceptibly, and I knew he had been using the wrong approach. Quite suddenly, the pewter helmet of her hair was disturbed by a cool gust of wind, and huge, clean, tumbling drops of rain began to spang around us from an almost cloudless sky. I'll give you a check now, I said abruptly, and saw Selena's green eyes triangulate angrily on my face. You can arrange delivery?
Delivery's no problem, said Hagen, getting to his feet. But wouldn't you rather take the glass with you?
Well, yeah, if you don't mind. I was shamed by his readiness to trust my script.
I'll unclip a pane for you. Wait here. It won't take long to slip it into a carrying frame.
Hagen limped down the slope toward the Syriot windows, through which some of the view towards Lenny was sunny, while others were cloudy and a few pure black. Selena drew the collar of her blouse closed at her throat. The least he could have done was invite us inside. There can't be so many fools passing through that he can afford to neglect them. I tried to ignore the insult and concentrated on writing the check. One of the outsized drops broke across my knuckles, splattering the pink paper. All right, now let's move in under the eaves till he gets back. You worm, I thought as I felt the whole thing go completely wrong. I just had to be a fool to marry you, a prize fool, a fool's fool. And now that you've trapped part of me inside you, I'll never, ever, never, ever, never, ever get away. Feeling my stomach clench itself painfully, I ran behind Selena to the side of the cottage. Beyond the window, the neat living room with its coal fire was empty, but the child's toys were scattered on the floor. Alphabet blocks and a wheelbarrow, the exact color of freshly pared carrots. As I stared in, the boy came running from the other room and began kicking the blocks. He didn't notice me. A few moments later, the young woman entered the room and lifted him, laughing easily and wholeheartedly as she swung the boy under her arm. She came to the window, as she had done earlier. I smiled self-consciously, but neither she nor the child responded. My forehead prickled icily. Could they both be blind? I sidled away. Selena gave a little scream and I spun towards her. The rug! It's getting soaked! She ran across the yard in the rain, snatched the reddish square from the dappling wall and ran back towards the cottage door. Something heaved convulsively in my subconscious and shouted, Selena, don't open it! But I was too late. She had pushed open the latched wooden door and was standing hand over mouth looking into the cottage. I moved close to her and took the rug from her unresisting fingers. As I was closing the door, I let my eyes traverse the cottage's interior. The neat living room in which I had just seen the woman and child was, in reality, a sickening clutter of shabby furniture, old newspapers, cast-off clothing, smeared dishes. It was damp, stinking, utterly deserted. The only object I recognized from my view through the window was the little wheelbarrow, paintless and broken. I latched the door firmly and ordered myself to forget what I had seen. Some men who live alone are good housekeepers. Others just don't know how. Selena's face was white. I don't understand. I don't understand it. Slow glass works both ways, I said gently. Light passes out of a house as well as in. You mean? I don't know. It's not our business. Now, steady up. Hagen's coming back with our glass. The churning in my stomach was beginning to subside. Hagen came into the yard carrying an oblong plastic-covered frame. I held the check out to him, but he was staring at Selena's face. He seemed to know immediately that our uncomprehending fingers had rummaged through his soul. Selena avoided his gaze. She was old and ill-looking, and her eyes stared determinedly towards the nearing horizon. I'll take the rug from you, Mr. Garland, Hagen finally said. You shouldn't have troubled yourself over it. Oh, no trouble. Here's a check. Thank you. He was still looking at Selena with a strange kind of supplication. It's been a pleasure to do business with you. The pleasure was mine. I picked up the heavy frame and guided Selena towards the path which led to the road. Just as we reached the head of the now slippery steps, Hagen spoke again. Mr. Garland? I turned unwillingly. Mr. Garland, it wasn't my fault. A hit-and-run driver got them both down on the Oban Road 6 years ago. My boy was only 7 when it happened. I'm entitled to keep something. I nodded wordlessly and moved down the path, holding my wife close to me, treasuring the feel of her arms locked around me. At the bend, I looked back through the rain and saw Hagen sitting with squared shoulders on the wall where we had first seen him. He was looking at the house, but I was unable to tell if there was anyone at the window. The title of our story this time is Light of Other Days, written by Bob Shaw. First appeared in Analog in 1966 and is reprinted in World's Best Science Fiction 1967. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production for MindWebs by Leslie Hilsenhoff. MindWebs comes to you from WHA Radio in Madison.
Two Military Executions by Ambrose Bierce. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. Read by Sean O'Hara. Two Military Executions by Ambrose Bierce. In the spring of the year 1862, General Buell's big army lay in camp, licking itself into shape for the campaign which resulted in the victory at Shiloh. It was a raw, untrained army, although some of its fractions had seen hard enough service, with a good deal of fighting in the mountains of western Virginia and in Kentucky. The war was young, and soldiering a new industry, imperfectly understood by the young American of the period, who found some features of it not altogether to his liking. Chief among these was that essential part of discipline, subordination. To one imbued from infancy with the fascinating fallacy that all men are born equal, unquestioning submission to authority is not easily mastered, and the American volunteer soldier, in his green and salad days, is among the worst known. That is how it happened that one of Buell's men, Private Bennett Story Green, committed the indiscretion of striking an officer. Later in the war, he would not have done that. Like Sir Andrew Aguecheek, he would have seen him damned first. But time for reformation of his military manners was denied him. He was promptly arrested on complaint of the officer, tried by court-martial, and sentenced to be shot. "He might have thrashed me and let it go at that," said the condemned man to the complaining witness. "That is what you used to do at school when you were playing Will Dudley and I was as good as you. Nobody saw me strike you. Discipline would not have suffered much." "Ben Green, I guess you're right about that," said the lieutenant. "Will you forgive me? That is what I came to see you about." There was no reply, and an officer putting his head in at the door of the guard tent where the conversation had occurred explained that the time allowed for the interview had expired. The next morning, when in the presence of the whole brigade, Private Green was shot to death by a squad of his comrades, Lieutenant Dudley turned his back upon the sorry performance and muttered a prayer for mercy in which he himself was included. A few weeks afterwards, as Buell's leading division was being ferried across the Tennessee River to assist in succoring Grant's beaten army, night was coming on, black and stormy. Through the wreck of battle, the division moved, inch by inch, in the direction of the enemy, who had withdrawn a little to reform his lines. But for the lightning, the darkness was absolute. Never for a moment did it cease, and ever when the thunder did not crack and roar, were heard the moans of the wounded among whom the men felt their way with their feet, and upon whom they stumbled in the gloom. The dead were there too. There were dead aplenty. In the first faint gray of the morning, when the swarming advance had paused to resume something of definition as a line of battle, and skirmishers had been thrown forward, word was passed along to call the roll. The first sergeant of Lieutenant Dudley's company stepped to the front and began to name the men in alphabetical order. He had no written roll, but a good memory. The men answered to their names as he ran down the alphabet to G.
Gorham?
Here.
Grayrock?
Here.
The sergeant's good memory was affected by habit.
Green? Here.
The response was clear, distinct, unmistakable. A sudden movement, an agitation of the entire company front, as from an electric shock, attested the startling character of the incident. The sergeant paled and paused. The captain strode quickly to his side and said sharply, "Call that name again." Apparently, the Society for Physical Research is not the first in the field of curiosity concerning the unknown.
"Bennett Green."
"Here."
All faces turned in the direction of the familiar voice. The two men between whom, in the order of stature, Green had commonly stood in line, turned and squarely confronted each other.
"Once more," commanded the inexorable investigator, and once more came, a trifle tremulously, the name of the dead man.
"Bennett Story Green?"
"Here."
At that instant, a single rifle shot was heard away to the front, beyond the skirmish line, followed, almost attended, by the savage hiss of an approaching bullet, which, passing through the line, struck audibly, punctuating, as with a full stop, the captain's exclamation,
"What the devil does it mean?"
Lieutenant Dudley pushed through the ranks from his place in the rear.
"It means this,"
he said, throwing open his coat and displaying a visibly broadening stain of crimson on his breast. His knees gave way, he fell awkwardly, and lay dead. A little later, the regiment was ordered out of line to relieve the congested front, and through some misplay in the game of battle was not again under fire. Nor did Bennett Green, expert in military executions, ever again signify his presence at one. End of Two Military Executions.
Guess what? This is a break. And no, I don't really like it either. At least I get to run off and hide until it's over. I'll be back real soon. ¶¶
Our final program tonight is an episode of Suspense, which originally aired on September the 16th of 1942.
Will you give a few seconds of your time to help win this war? Then listen. At Stalingrad the other day, a Nazi tank unit attacked a corps of Russian soldiers. The Russians tried to stop the tanks and fought until their guns were silenced. Then did they surrender? Did they retreat? No. 18 of them rushed forward with bombs in their hands, got under the tanks, and blew them up. They gave their lives for their country. You and I are not asked to give our lives for ours. All we're asked to do is buy war bonds and stamps. Our American soldiers are giving their lives for us each day. More and more of them every day. Can we do less than loan our money to them? It's such a simple, easy thing to do. Out of every dollar you earn, lend one dime to your country. Do it regularly by joining the 10% Club where you work. And do it now. Our soldiers need your help.
Columbia Network takes pleasure in bringing you Suspense. Suspense, Columbia's parade of outstanding thrillers. Produced by William Speer and scored by Bernard Herrmann. The notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense. Tonight's story deals with a remote and dangerous house. The terrifying thing that happened there because the rain went on for days and days. It deals with a surgeon and a girl, a giant, and a young man who took a long chance. And over them all, the moan of the night wind and the ceaseless roar of the storm. For your suspenseful listening, we invite you to learn about Method. 4 days of rain had been ceaseless, teeming, pouring with a steady, relentless rhythm. 4 solid days. The fields around Culston had been turned into huge puddles that reflected the heavy, swollen sky. And Dr. Morrissey was stirred by a deep anxiety. He stood beside a window in his sanitarium, which rose high on a lonely hill, a few miles from the little town of Culston, and stared into the jagged, spraying screen of rain. It was just 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock of an afternoon he would long remember. He was on the point of sending for Caffrey, the ward attendant, when the door opened, and Caffrey came in, pale.
Dr. Morrissey.
Is there anything wrong, Caffrey?
I don't know. There's a feeling down in the ward.
Feeling?
This rain's gone on too long.
The patient's getting uneasy?
They're bound to, ain't they? If a guy with good nerves, he gets jumpy. You can imagine what it does to theirs.
Seems to be affecting anyone in particular.
Number 5 has been carrying on.
Hitler?
Yeah. I brought him up. Nurse Carter's waiting with him out in the hall.
Bad as that?
He's upsetting the others. Keeps asking for some guy named Benham.
That's the man he killed.
I didn't know he was homicidal.
Oh, it was an accident. He was performing a brain surgery on Benham and...
Him?
Oh, Kettler was a very important surgeon, Caffrey. Didn't you know that?
He keeps saying so, but...
It's perfectly true. Very successful, Dr. Kettler was. Until he perfected an operative procedure that he called the Kettler method. A new process of brain operation. Spent most of his life on it and... Well, when he tried it for the first time on this young Laird Benham and Benham died on the table, it unbalanced his mind.
I've got to go back down there now.
I think you'd better wait while I talk with Kettler.
Okay, I'll bring him in. But don't make it long. I don't like the feel of things around here. Nurse,
Miss Carter.
Yes, we're coming.
You can bring him in now.
Come along. Dr. Morris, he wants to see you.
Does he now? Does he? Come in, Kettler. I'd like to ask Dr. Morrissey a question. I'd like to ask him a question.
Yes, Dr. Kettler.
I should like to ask him where Laird Benham is. I know he'll never tell me.
But I will, Kettler. Laird Benham is buried somewhere out there under the rain. He is at peace, Kettler. Can't you forget about him? Just forget.
You'd all like me to forget about him, wouldn't you? Then you could keep him hidden away forever, couldn't you?
Benham is dead, Kettler. You know that.
Benham died.
He did not.
He's alive. He was alive when you and the rest of the envious medical profession stole him from the operating table. Kidnapped him with my bandages still around his head. You were determined to make the Kettler method seem a failure, weren't you? Weren't you?
Easy, easy now.
Believe me, Kettler.
Benham died.
He is now, Dr. Morrissey. He's in the cellar under the ward downstairs, isn't he? Isn't he?
Kettler.
Let me see him. Benham.
Oh, you'd better take him down, Caffrey.
All right. Come along now, sir. I'll take him, nurse.
You won't show him to me. Even though it would make me well again.
My cellars are empty, Kettler. Believe me, Benham isn't there.
You sit there in power and order me away.
Come on, Kettler. There's something I have to say. I've always been above violence, Dr. Morrissey. But the time comes when there's no other course. This is a warning, Doctor. A warning. And the joke is that you won't heed it.
Come on with you.
You won't heed it now. But you'll remember it. And soon you'll remember it. Tables turn, Dr. Morrissey. Tables turn.
Poor thing.
I'm afraid I'm failing with him. Failing completely.
But you're not. It takes time to put a man back together.
Oh, it's taking me too long with Kettler. I'm beginning to be afraid.
If you'll pardon me, Doctor.
Yes?
I do think you're making a mistake.
With him?
No, with yourself. You haven't had a real vacation in 3 years, Dr. Morrissey.
Oh, you think I'm wearing a bit thin just now, don't you? And you're right. But I really can't leave my patients in anyone else's hands. Not now, at any rate. No, I'll have to make the best of it.
But you need relaxation.
I know, I know. Well, I hope to soothe my ragged nerves somewhat over this weekend.
Oh?
I have some friends coming down from the city Friday night. Leslie and Claire Winton. Young married couple, newlyweds. And I'm just going to relax with them and forget everything until Monday morning.
You must, Doctor. You do need it so badly. Oh, by the way, Doctor.
Yes?
I slipped some of those new sample bandages into your coat pocket.
Well, thanks. I'll have a look at them.
I think they're quite good. The salesman said that...
Yes, nurse. What is it?
Did you hear something?
Thunder, wasn't it?
Something else besides thunder. I thought it.
Well, I didn't hear it.
My nerves must be getting the best of me. Perhaps it's a case of nurse, heal thyself, eh?
I'm not the only one who needs a rest. You know, it might be a very good idea if we both...
Dr. Morrissey.
I heard that.
What is it?
Coming from the ward. Sounds like... That was a shot. Nurse, you get on the phone. Call the police at Colson.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Keep at it.
Hello?
Someone's trying to get in from the hall.
Dr. Morrissey!
Caffrey, just a moment. Caffrey, what is it?
James, up with me. All of them coming up the stairs. Kettler, clear out of here.
Steady, nurse.
He's dead, isn't he?
Yes.
Dr. Morrissey.
Kettler.
Remember my warning. Remember it, Doctor. Tables turn, Dr. Morrissey. Tables turn.
Rained for 3 more days. Friday night came, black, wet, and glistening. The 8:15 express groaned into Colston Station, bringing Leslie and Claire Winton out from the city with their weekend luggage.
Isn't Dr. Moore, is he sending his car for us, Leslie?
Yes, Claire. The chauffeur was supposed to drive us over to the sanitarium to pick up the doc, and then we're all going over to his house together.
Well, I don't see any car, do you?
I don't see anything but water. Maybe we're rolling over in a skiff.
Oh, I hate that sound. Like somebody's in agony.
I think you're a little depressed, dear.
Well, I shouldn't be surprised. My head's still aching dreadfully.
Poor lover. How long's that been going on now?
Almost a week. It frightens me.
I don't think it's anything serious.
Waiting in the rain like this doesn't do it any good, I'm sure.
I don't understand. Doc's usually so punctual. Right on the dot. You don't suppose we ought to call the sanitarium?
You people, or Dr. Morrissey, yes?
Well, yes, we're the Wintons. Doc sent you to pick us up?
Aye, Cato. Dr. Morrissey's chauffeur. You got luggage?
Yes. Here it is.
I take. You follow me to car. Come.
We're coming.
Leslie?
Yes?
He's tremendous, isn't he? He must be 6.5 feet tall.
I'm over 6 myself, darling. He's nearer 8. That's a giant. Get those shoulders. He could snap me in two like a matchstick.
Well, I hope he likes us.
So do I, light of my life.
Ah, waiting. You come, please.
But I really don't think he does. Coming.
The car lurched and hurtled over the rain-soaked road, tearing wildly through the dark and careening up the hillside toward the stark walls of the sanitarium. It skidded to a standstill in front of the main entrance, and cold, black Cato led them inside. The brightly lit corridors were deserted, silent, like hallways in a nightmare. Claire was aware of her headache growing steadily worse as Cato opened the double doors and ushered them into the waiting room.
You'll tell Dr. Morrissey we're here, huh?
Doctor, be with you soon. You do not go away.
Yes, thanks.
I hope we're not staying in here very long.
It isn't very cheery, is it?
Oh, I don't like places like this. I suppose it's very foolish of me, but I always feel as if I'm in some sort of danger.
That's the headache again. Everything seems worse than it really is when you're not feeling well. Don't you always find...
Leslie.
Yes?
Listen. What is it?
Somebody's knocking. Just a moment.
Gracias a Dios.
Who is it, Leslie?
I don't know.
What, you do not know me? I am Arturo Alvarez, the South American pianist. You have heard of me?
Well, sure, I've heard of Arturo Alvarez, but I'd hardly expect to find him.
Leslie, humor him.
Oh, of course, for a moment I forgot where I was. I've heard of you, Mr. Alvarez. Is there anything I can do for you?
Will you help me? I must get out of this place.
Oh, sure.
I came here several days ago to be treated for a mild nervous trouble. Now they won't let me go. I am being held a prisoner. And tonight I am scheduled to give a concert at Carnegie Hall, and I must get out of here. Please, will you help me?
Number 10 out of the ward again, I see. How many times must I tell you that is strictly against the rules?
I was doing nothing wrong. I was only telling this gentleman that I must be at Carnegie Hall for my concert.
Yes. I'm sure the gentleman was very interested. Cato.
Yes, doctor.
Cato, you will escort number 10 back to the ward and see to it that he doesn't wander back into the waiting room.
No, I will not be taken back to the ward. Help me.
Oh, no.
Help me. No.
How strongly he believes in his delusion. Strange fantasy of a diseased mind. Seriously believes that he's Arturo Alvarez.
He was telling me.
Oh, I'm very sorry. I'm afraid I haven't been very cordial. Won't you sit down? Is there anything I can do for you?
Well, you see, Dr. Morrissey invited us up for the weekend.
Oh, yes, of course. He told me he was expecting you.
Does he know we're here?
I'm afraid not. Dr. Morrissey was unexpectedly called away on an emergency case, and I'm in charge of the sanitarium until he returns.
Well, do you have any idea about when that'll be?
Well, it's very hard to say. However, he asked me to ask you to wait and see to it that you're made comfortable. You see now, your name is...
Winton, Leslie Winton. And this is my wife, Claire.
Ah, yes. Permit me to introduce myself.
yourself. I'm Dr. Kettler. Dr. Morrissey's assistant. What can I do for you? A bite of food or a drink, perhaps?
I don't think so.
There's nothing in the world I want so much as an aspirin.
Aspirin? Yes, doctor. She's had a headache that's been troubling her for days. It's terribly annoying.
I can well imagine. Annoying and interesting. That is to a man of my profession, of course. But if you will step into the inner office, I think I can offer you something a good deal more effective.
Oh, I'd hate to trouble you.
No trouble at all. I find these things most intriguing.
Should I, Leslie?
I think you might as well. Morrissey won't be back for a long time by the looks of things.
Yes, you're quite right, Mr. Winton. Dr. Morrissey won't be back for a long, long time.
Oh, well, then, which way do I go?
Right this way. The large door on your left.
You won't mind waiting alone, will you, darling?
Oh, Mr. Winton shall make himself comfortable. There are cigarettes in the box, whiskey in the liquor cabinet, and a radio behind the ferns there. I'm sure he'll be quite happy. After you, Mrs. Winton.
If Dr. Morrissey comes in, let me know.
I hope you'll find everything you want, sir.
Thanks. By the way, doctor.
Yes?
You said you had something better than aspirin. I didn't know there was anything better than aspirin for a headache.
I have something, Mr. Winton.
Really?
It's a process which I invented myself. One that never fails. A little treatment, very effective, and highly complicated, called the Kettler Method. Please make yourself at home, Mr. Winton. Leslie sat there, alone in the big waiting room for a while. Then creeps began setting in, and he thought to himself,
maybe I'll have that drink after all.
He rose and went over to the liquor cabinet that Kettler had pointed out to him and opened it.
Well, there's nothing in here but books.
Yes, books. Books that were so thick with dust that it was clear they'd been there for months. No drink for Leslie. Maybe a cigarette. Kettler said the box was full. He picked it up and started opening it.
Why, it isn't even a cigarette box. The darn thing's a bookend.
Yes, that's just what it was. Leslie began to think it was a tough job making himself at home in that waiting room. And then the idea occurred to him.
Maybe the radio works.
He went over to the radio then, turned it on, and...
We are sorry to announce that the program scheduled for this time from Carnegie Hall has been canceled due to the mysterious disappearance of Arturo Alvarez, the noted South American pianist. Mr. Alvarez was known to be suffering from a minor nervous disorder and was last seen departing on a short trip to Colston in upstate New York.
Alvarez? That guy is Alvarez. What's going on here?
Claire! Claire!
Look.
Dr. Kettler, open this door. Open it. Did you hear me?
It's Claire. Winter.
You. Tell him to open up. Tell him. Tell him.
Doctor, send me. Tell you, young lady, headache, bad, very bad.
What do you mean?
He operate.
Operate?
He say take long time. He say you not wake. You come back tomorrow.
Operate? No, no. Kettler, Kettler! Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Of course he can hear you, Mr. Winton. The operating table is just inside the door.
Bring her out here. Let her go, I tell you, Kettler.
But I find that an operation is indicated, Mr. Winton.
I forbid you to touch her.
You forbid?
You?
I'm in charge here. No one forbids me. Do you understand?
You're insane. If you lay your hands on her, I'll kill you. So help me, I'll kill you.
Very well, Mr. Winton. You do not wish me to operate. That's all there is to it. I would scarcely force my service upon you. However, the girl's condition is quite serious, and I...
Good work. Good work, Cato, my boy. A masterstroke. Do you still forbid me, Mr. Winton? Do you? Do you?
Oh, you don't answer. Good, good. Take him to the cellar, Cato, and lodge him there with his friend, Dr. Morrissey. Yes. They should have a good deal to talk over in the still hours of the night while I cure the young lady's headache unmolested.
Got to pull yourself together, Leslie. I'll try. Try to think. Cato brought you down a few moments ago. You've been hit in the head. Can you remember?
Yes. I was talking to Kettler, trying to make him let Claire go. Claire. Oh, good Lord, Morrissey.
Where is she?
He's got her.
Kettler?
She's on that operating table up there. We've got to do something. We've got to do something.
Well, I'm afraid there's not much we can do. I've been here for 3 days and nights.
What happened?
It was a nightmare come to life. I'd had Kettler in my office for treatment.
Here?
He was off on a wild tangent, insisting that I had a man whom he had killed hidden down here in the cellar. That I and the rest of the medical profession had kidnapped him off the operating table with his head still swathed. He thinks I've been keeping this venom from him all along, even though I've known that just one side of him would cure his mental disorders. He hates me with every fiber of his twisted brain. It's a dangerous case, Leslie.
He'll kill Claire?
He may. There's a slim chance he won't.
What's that?
Well, all the surgical instruments are locked away. It's possible they may not be able to find me.
Isn't there any way we can get out of here?
Well, couldn't I have used it?
Where does that corridor lead to?
To the staircase that goes to the first floor.
Well?
Not a chance. Comes out of the operating room and they keep that door locked as tight as a drum. Besides, Kettler still has the pistol he took from my nurse.
I've got to think. I've got to. My head hurts so I can't make good sense.
Hey, let's see that. I think they gave you a nasty cut.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Say, Doc.
Yes?
What was his name?
Who?
The guy Kettler thought you were keeping from him. The one he killed.
Benham. Ed Benham. Why?
Was he a young fellow?
Yes, rather tall, slender chap.
Say, Doc.
Hmm?
Do you have any bandages down here?
What?
Bandages.
Why, yes, I think so. They're stored down here.
Enough to bandage my whole head, face, and everything?
Why?
I might have a chance of getting through that door up there.
Please, let me go now. Oh, let me go. Leslie!
You will be better soon. Much better. I will take the pain away, Mrs. Winton.
Cato! Have you found the surgical case?
Not found yet. I look. Cato, look.
Find it. We must not keep Mrs. Winton in agony. Find it, I say. She'll have to create some order in this place. I want my instruments at hand on a moment's notice.
Please, let me go. Oh, let me go.
You shall be well again, my dear. I promise you, you shall be.
Doctor, here, tall, white cabinet behind curtain.
That's it. Open it. Open it, Cato.
Locked. Locked, Doctor.
Smash it open. Open it.
I do.
You'll find scalpels on the top tray. Bring them to me.
Yes, Doctor. It's here, Doctor. See, knives. Good, sharp knives. Cato find. He find them.
Excellent. How they glitter. It is good to feel the knife in my hand again. Put the others right beside my pistol here on the table.
Please.
There, my girl. I shall expend all my genius on you. You should be well again.
No!
Now to work. What was that? Who's there?
Dr. Kessler.
Who is it?
I have found my way back to you. Open the door, Dr. Kessler. I've come back again.
Who are you?
You remember? You remember Laird Benham?
Cato! Cato!
Yes, Doctor.
The door! The door! Let him in! He's come back! Let him in, I say!
Oh, let me out of here!
He's come back! He's come back, Cato!
Dr. Kessler.
Benham, I knew it. I knew it all along. You're alive. You're living.
Yes. Yes, Dr. Kessler.
You. Just as they took you from the table.
Yes. They took me away before the operation was complete. Finish it now. Hurry. I can't live much longer. I'm about to die.
No, no. Cato! Get Benham out of the table.
Girl on table.
Take her off. Take her out of here. Put her in the cellar. Let Benham take her place. At once, you hear?
Yes, Dr. Cato.
No. No, I won't be put in the cellar. I won't.
It might be well if you went down into the cellar, you know. It's nice down there. You'll see old friends, perhaps. Old friends will need help.
Hurry! Hurry, I say!
Yes, Doctor. Come.
I'm coming.
Are you all right, Benham?
Weaker.
Cato!
Close the door.
No, stop wasting time. Leave the door alone. Help me. Help me get Benham on the table.
Yes, Doctor. Cato, do.
Oh, that's right. Look him carefully.
Good.
Now, lie back. Lie back. Gently. Gently. All right. Careful now.
There we are. Cato, give me the knife.
Yes, doctor.
Take off the bandages. From the top, Cato. That's correct. That's proper procedure. Yeah. Yeah, now that's... I thought his hair was blonde, not black. Well, perhaps I've forgotten. I've forgotten so many things that... There was a scar on his forehead. I clearly remember a scar on his forehead. Maybe I imagined that too. That's with someone else. Brown eyes. Denim, didn't you have blue eyes? I know they were blue. And your nose. Your nose was thinner and longer. Yes. And your lips. You had thick lips. That I know.
Bandages off, Doctor.
Dr. Kettler, there's a trick here. You're not Denim. You're not Denim. You're that young Mr. Winter.
Dr. Kettler, listen to me.
Cheat. So you wanted me to finish you, did you? Yes, Mr. Winton, I will. I will. Hold him, Cato. Hold him. See the knife, Mr. Winton? Watch it glisten as it comes down, and into the...
Arthur Alvarez when you hear him play the piano, do you?
That's a marvelous old instrument you have, Doc.
It was my mother. This old house has been in the family for generations.
Who'd ever thought we'd be alive to sit in your house and listen to somebody play a concerto?
We wouldn't have been. At least I wouldn't have been if you hadn't snatched that revolver off the table right out from under Kepler's nose before they threw you into the cellar. That was the lifesaver. Made the weekend perfect.
I'm afraid it wasn't very restful.
Hereafter, I'm spending all weekends in a cozy little corner under the L.
It was worse for Claire than anybody. She had a dreadful time.
It was ghastly, all right. Horrible. But you know something?
What?
My headache. It's completely gone.
Ends the Kepler Method, the tale of a memorable weekend and a long-awaited dead man who didn't return after all. This was tonight's story of Suspense. Suspense is produced by William Spear. John Dietz was our director this evening. Tonight's radio drama was written by Peter Barry and scored by Bernard Herrmann. Roger DeCoven was Dr. Kepler, John Gibson, Leslie Winton, and Gloria Stewart played Claire Winton. Others in the cast were Guy Repp, Martha Faulkner, Winfield Honey, and Ralph Smiley. Next week at this time, Columbia will bring you another selected story from the world's great literature of thrill. Another study in... Suspense. This is Barry Kroger, and this is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Well, my 120 minutes are pretty much up. This has been Night Transmissions. I have been Gary Clinton. And with a little luck, we'll see each other next week. Bye.